Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Infernal Brains podcast. I'm Tars Tarkas from TarsTarkas.net.
And I'm Todd Statman from Die Danger, Die Die Kill, aka 40K.
And once again, we have a special guest brain joining us in the studios. Please welcome Durian Day from the Soft Film Blogspot.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And of course, the fact that Dave is here means that we're going to be discussing Chinese language cinema of some kind, most likely Chinese language cinema that involves martial arts, and even more likely that it involves ass kicking women of some kind.
Yes.
In this in this case, one of our personal faves, the actress Pearl Changling. And Dave, we've all been kind of filling the internet with Pearl lately, but I think you've been guilty of that more than any of us. You've been doing a series of blog posts about Pearl lately. Can you want to talk about where that, what's the deal with that, man?
Well, besides, being a little obsessive, I don't know. I don't know where I should start with this, but I've only recently discovered Pearl and her films, and that was last year, thanks to talking with you, Todd.
Yeah, I'm partially responsible for
Yeah.
this spiral you found yourself in. I
Yeah,
totally
you hooked me up
responsibility
with
for
the
that.
goods, and
Yeah, I did. First one's free.
I just went out of control. So, and I know I really, I don't know, felt a special bond with Pearl, and I was one of the things when we you were writing a review for Wolf Devil Woman for Teleport City, or revising your old review, and telling me how hard it was to find information about her, and I really love a good research challenge. So that was, I think even before I started watching her films, I started to, try to find out more about her.
Well, one thing about Pearl is that she really sort of invites examination because she is sort of a mysterious figure, or at least I got in the habit of referring to her as the mysterious Pearl Changling because for me, it was hard for me to. I loved her films, but there's very little information on the English language web about her.
Yeah, and even with how recent her films are, it's surprising how little there is, even still now, with even all the stuff Dave dug up, there's still,
Yeah, so what I discovered, of course, there's her films that are popular in the West. I mean, more than, not really popular, I would say notorious with cult movie fans. And at first that was all I could find about her, but then when I started to try to find some Chinese language material about her, that's when I discovered that she was this huge TV star during the mid-70s in this martial arts TV show called The Protectors in Taiwan. And I mean, she was, a gigantic star. I mean, everyone in Taiwan watched this show, and it was popular in Hong Kong and Singapore. And
And Chiang Kai-shek was a big fan of
yeah,
her, yeah.
evidently the then president slash dictator of Taiwan was a huge fan of the show. In particular, he was a huge fan of Pearl Chang. And so it was like a really iconic show for, I think, anyone growing up in Taiwan or Hong Kong or Singapore
And
during
if I
that.
understand, I'm sorry, excuse me. And if I understand correctly, this was a show that came on like every night, right? And it was like 90, it was a 90-minute show that came on every single night. And
Yeah,
yeah.
it started off as a half hour show, and it was going to be, it was conceived as a sort of limited series, but it became so popular they were getting all these advertisers wanting to advertise, so they're like, oh, we got to like increase the length of the show so we can sell more advertising, and then it became this thing where, they're literally just making up the show each day as they're shooting. And one article I had translated talked about, it was this show that, everyone kind of thought was just total nonsense, but they just couldn't stop watching it anyway, because the plot was just ridiculous. veering off in all kinds of unexpected directions, and But for whatever reason, and unfortunately, as far as I know, I don't think it survives. I mean, maybe it's in the archives of the CTS television station.
Right.
But for whatever reason, it just captured people's imagination, and Pearl Chang was sort of a part of that. She, throughout the course of the show, her role became bigger and bigger until she was really the star of the show.
Right.
And so in for Chinese people, she was this sort of iconic swordswoman in a traditional mode, you know,
mm-hmm.
very filial to her father and, you know, maybe a little hot-headed and
mm-hmm.
but still, you know, very much an old-fashioned swordswoman.
Yeah, more in mm-hmm. the more in the tradition of sort of the 50s and 60s wuxia movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I found that really interesting how for Chinese audiences, she had this image. And then in the West, there was this complete opposite image of this, like, total crazy lady, you know, that, you know, tears apart, you know, live chickens and bunnies and eats them, and
which is also earned, I have to say, though. I mean, it, that's the thing that's fascinating about her. But yeah, she does in the West, she is more of, to the degree that she's known, she is known as a star of basically psychotronic or cult mm-hmm. cinema, and that's as a result of a very small subset of her films that were made within a very short amount of time, basically yeah. films that were made in like between 1981 and 1983.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And also, which are notable, I mean, she's also known for the fact, and this is important, that she actually directed those films.
Yeah, which that's is right.
pretty rare. I don't really know. I haven't heard of any other female directors in Chinese martial arts cinema during that period, and she was not only a director, but a couple of the films she also wrote and produced, so they were basically auteur films that she did.
Yeah, definitely. There was one other female director of martial arts and action figure films that I know is Gao Baoshu, who was actress at Shaw Brothers.
Mm.
And during the 70s, she after I think she'd left Shaw's at the time, she did a couple films, and I've not seen them, so I can't comment. But she wasn't doing what Pearl was doing, which was really creating her own story and presenting it on screen.
Yeah. She was definitely, you get a sense with her, especially the contrast between the way she presents herself in her self-directed films and the way she's presented in her earlier films. You definitely get a sense of her seizing control of her own image
mm-hmm.
and yeah. sort of the way that she wanted to present herself. Or at least that's, you know, it's definitely accessible in that way. You want to grab onto that narrative of here's a woman in a male-dominated mm-hmm. industry taking control of her image. But it's also interesting for what she did with her image, because when you see those films, they are very idiosyncratic. And at the same time, Dave, I agree, you know, I liked in some of your posts where you're talking about Pearl, you were trying to sort of rescue her from this sort of WTF mentality, which is like a lot of what's written about her and what's written about a lot of films is like, you know, it's just about, these films are weird, mm-hmm. you know, without really delving into them beyond that. It's just sort of reading them on the surface, you know, and they are strange films, but I kind of, you know, I have actually, I think a lot of people accuse me of doing that too, but I actually don't, I kind of reject that approach because generally there's no effort to put the films in any kind of context. It's a little glib. Go ahead.
Oh, the weirdness, it gets them known, but when you then you look at them and you see them, then you learn more about them, then you see there's these whole other things going on, and then there's a lot of other films that in Taiwan at the same time that were similarly have a lot of the same things going on that are also considered weird, but like she had nothing to do with them, so it's it's a lot bigger than just, you know, these five films are crazy and she's crazy. It's like, you know, there's stuff there.
Yeah, I mean, part of what I wanted to do is, I mean, I don't want to, I don't know, make her normal because she she is you know, a very eccentric character. And even her film Miraculous Flower, a literal translation of the Chinese title is like kind of the strange or like rare flower, you know, mm-hmm. beyond compare. And so I think she definitely adopted a very strange and eccentric persona. But when you add on like the horrible dubbing and I mean, if you look at the way the film was sort of marketed in the West with the bizarre posters, and it just gets really, I mean, I think that the sort of marketing of her films in the West is more bizarre than her films.
Sure. And there's a few things going on with those films too. I mean, if you take a film like Wolf Devil Woman, which I think is probably the most notorious of her films and the most well known over here, I mean, there's her sensibility, which is a little strange. And there's her approach to performance, which I think her performance is also sort of, there's a feeling to her performances in those movies where it does feel like she's kind of pushing back against the image that she had before, where she's kind of cutting loose a little more. There she's kind of plays the clown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's that aspect. There's her own eccentricity, but there's also the fact, you know, that she was obviously working with very small budgets. So you get the kind of weirdness you get when you're trying to do these very ambitious films with a lot of effects, mm-hmm. a lot of fight sequences with no money. So you have things in Wolf Devil Woman, where one of the bad guys is clearly just wearing like the kind of rubber fright mask you could get at Woolworths here, you know, and just weird sets that are very obviously incorporate tinfoil and just all the kind of things that people sort of stereotypically make fun of B movies for, where they say, oh, the sets were made of cardboard and tinfoil. Well, you know, in some of these movies, in Dark Lady of Kung Fu, there's definitely sets that are made out of cardboard and tinfoil. So there's sort of like all the combination of her own eccentricities, which just sort of the shortcomings and the challenges that she had to deal with making movies all kind of collude into the overall kind of strangeness. And then, yes, and then you have the weird dubbing, which in some cases makes them even better. And then there's in some of these films, they definitely get it. I think her editing style is definitely pretty distinct and can be very herky jerky. But I imagine that some of these films went through some pretty severe editing too in the course of being, you know, translated into different markets. I mean, I think there were some things in Dark Lady of Kung Fu that were very hard to follow.
There's definitely parts of that one missing. And then the two versions of Miraculous Flower I have different scenes. So there's parts missing in some of the dubbing. And then I don't know, but neither one of those are in Chinese. So I don't know if there's a third version that has everything together or not. So,
right. Right. So these are the kind of things like when you get obsessed like we do and you actually bother to delve into these movies, you find that, you know, there's like a lot of context to explain why they're so strange. In a way, it's more fun to not look into that and just kind of take them at face value and go, you know, wow, you know, this is insane, you know, and, you know, there's something to be said for that. But
yeah, that gets old after a while, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think all of three of us like to do this is provide a sort of context for these films, because you can definitely just appreciate them on face value. But when, for me, like, I like to know about the context of the film. I like to create a little landscape or sort of portrait for the film. And like with Pearl's films, I'm still like really trying to paint that picture right now. 'Cause there's like, for me, just to give one example, is like, in some of her films, like Wolf Devil Woman and, you know, Dark Lady of Kung Fu, I think in some ways that they're more effective if you take them as children's films. Mm-hmm. But of course, in the West, that would be like, oh my God, this could never be a children's film because it's so violent. But
mm-hmm. right.
I think it could be, you know, in Taiwan and Hong Kong, where they're, I think, used to, I don't know,
well, there's not
higher levels of violence than is what's considered acceptable.
Right.
You know, here. Yeah. And but I think there's
level of sentimentality about childhood that we have in the West.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they probably think it's okay to expose kids to a little bit of violence because it prepares them for the world.
There's no shrieking mothers thinking, won't somebody think of the children?
Right. You know, here they look for someone that they can get arrested for something like that. And there, I think they take a little more in stride, for better or for worse, you know. For all the parents that listen to the Infernal Brains podcast.
Well, I did find one blog review of, I think, Matching Escort, who he would wholeheartedly recommend it to kids around the age of 8 or 10, which I thought was cool, you know, because if I would have loved these movies at the age of 10. I mean, it would have changed my life, because I was already reading, like, you know, Robert E. Howard's Conan stories, and this stuff would have been perfect for me. But one of the things I think that's good about thinking of him this way is, I think, especially with sort of the film's cheapness, is if you sort of just suspend your adult disbelief and just accept this as make-believe, you know,
absolutely,
and not get hung up on, like, oh, you know, that's made out of cardboard, or that's like a rubber mask, you know.
Yeah.
If you can do that, I think you can really appreciate it on, you know, another level that you may not be able to if you're always sort of distancing yourself.
Right. No, I agree with you totally. I mean, I think things like that, it's something that I've said about Bollywood movies too, like the crudity of special effects in a lot of Bollywood movies. I feel like it sort of invites your suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes you part of the process. It's like the movie saying, you know, come on, I'm not going to do all the work for you. You know, or it's sort of like Doctor Who, like old Doctor Who episodes, same thing. I think I was reading someone describing it that way, where it's, you know, it's like just like one step above radio. You know, the effects are just enough to sort of suggest the idea of what you're supposed to be seeing. And then you enter into it and you complete it, you know, you suspend your disbelief. So I totally
agree. Yeah, because you're taking these too serious, you're doing it wrong. That's pretty much it. It's
absolutely.
Since we've already started going into the films, I wonder if we should just back up a bit, and I can give you just a brief overview of some of the information I've discovered about her Pearl's upbringing and early career. So all this information I've had to find through Chinese language sources, and actually had to get them translated through friends and other people I know. Let me just start at the beginning. Pearl was born in Taiwan in 1955, and at a young age, around 5 or 6, she started learning dancing and all the various Chinese folk dances, like sword dance, and was also studied ballet. And from what I've read, it was, I guess, because of her sort of poor health that she was encouraged to build her strength and stamina through these exercises. At some point when she was young, her mother died. I'm not sure exactly when. And from the articles I've read, she had a very strong affection for her father, who sort of, you might say, forced almost, but, you know, made her learn, you know, calligraphy. And she had a really structured childhood that emphasized traditional Chinese values. Mm-hmm. And she studied Chinese opera and martial art. And when she was 16 years old, now I'm not sure where this sort of fits in with the Taiwan school system, but maybe just after their equivalent of high school, she joined the CTV television station, which I'm not sure, it might have been the first TV station in Taiwan, and it was owned by the government. Mm-hmm. I don't think she got a lot of roles at first. And meanwhile, at the same time, she was also studying journalism at college. Eventually, she started getting small roles in TV shows and some film work. And more of these started to be martial arts films. One of her first films, Return of the Hero of the Waterfront, she kind of plays a damsel in distress character, although does have one fight scene. You can almost imagine her, you know, like convincing the director to, like, give her at least, you know, one punch, you know.
Right.
And then that was in 1973. In 1974, she was in a film called Fist of Shaolin, where starts getting a better fighting role. She has a couple good scenes in that. And I've got clips of all these up on my YouTube channel, and you can see them on my Pearl Chang Tumblr.
One thing, can I just interrupt and say one thing? Because I need to say this for my own conscience. One of the many mistakes I've made in writing about Pearl's films is that I've on occasion said that she wasn't much of a fighter because her own films used a lot of wire work and a lot of trick photography and quick cutting. And I was wrong about that, especially after I watched Miraculous Flower again. She did have skills, and she obviously did have some martial arts training. So I just wanted to set the record straight on that as far as my errors. Because I may not go back and fix those articles, so I'm at least going to say it here.
Yeah, she's pretty tough. If you watch her early films, which are more just straight up wuxia films with not a lot of crazy wire work like her later stuff. I mean, she's definitely got the moves. But it's interesting, you see in the early part of her career, still, you know, she's playing second fiddle to the male leads. And then in 1974, she starts this TV show, The Protectors. Comes this huge hit. The show was temporarily suspended when Chiang Kai-shek died in April or so of 1975. There was no entertainment in Taiwan for a month to encourage or make people mourn his passing. And one rumor,
and they were probably, a lot of them were probably just mourning that they couldn't watch Pearl Chang Ling on TV every night. Yeah.
Yes. But an funny rumor I heard was that Chiang Kai-shek really loved the show and encouraged its success and with his influence, because that CTS was a government controlled station. And I don't know all the details, but the gist of it that I got was that he, you know, arranged maybe to have other shows canceled. And at one time, the plot line gave Pearl three suitors who wanted to take her hand in marriage. And I guess Chiang Kai-shek didn't like that. So, like, the next day, all three of them were killed. And really fascinating how she fits in with just Taiwan's culture and political culture. And evidently, Chiang Kai-shek's son, who took control of the presidency after his father died, did not like the show. And 1 month after the mourning period had passed, the show was over. I don't know if there were any politics involved in that or if it had just sort of run its course. And
This is giving me an idea for a alternative history novel I want to write. I want to write about,
that would be cool,
millennial America, where 2.5 men is shown for 90 minutes every night, and George Bush decrees that everyone has to watch it under threat of imprisonment. It sounds sort of like...
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because one account I read of someone from Hong Kong who remembers the show, he was like, well, he said, you know, at the time, everyone was living in the big government housing units and it's hot there. So their doors are open. The show's playing, you know, late at night. And he said you could hear the show. You could hear the dialogue clearly, you know, every night, all night. And he said one of the reasons why everyone knows the theme song to the show is because it was kind of like brainwashing. They heard it, like, you know, every night of the week.
Yeah, that's right. And the theme song was sung by Pearl Chang Ling.
Yeah.
I actually had a friend translate an article. He had his mother translate an article about Pearl for him, and he said the minute that he showed her the article, she just automatically started singing the theme song.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, so it's true. It definitely is.
You know, something similar happened to me when I was in Taipei last year. I was looking around. There's this building with all these antique stalls, and I was trying to find Pearl Chang memorabilia, and I had a picture of her on my iPod, so I pulled it out and was showing these guys. And as soon as saying her name and them not quite understanding who I was referring to, but then this one older guy saw the picture, and he immediately broke out into the singing song too. So it must be true. It was pretty remarkable. Or I don't, you know, maybe it was just indicative of this poverty of television. Who knows? I mean, it's hard to say, but...
Well, all we have, the only artifact we have to refer to is that they made a feature version.
Yeah,
of the series, or more or less, right?
Yeah, I think it's the character is not quite the same. The name is definitely different, and whether that's because of, I don't know, copyright issues. One rumor I read in an article that I had translated was that before she made the China Armed Escort with Chen Minghua, who was the director of the TV show, she'd actually signed on to make a version of the show with another company, but ended up quitting because she thought that they didn't know what they were doing, that they were unprofessional, and ended up forming a partnership with director Chen, and got, because of this, got this rumor in the film industry of being difficult to work with. And that's actually something that comes up in a lot of these articles, is kind of headstrong perfectionist tendency and sort of wanting to, be more in control than maybe people, were comfortable with.
Yeah, which is something obviously you have to take with a grain of salt, given that it was probably not, appreciated for a woman in that context to be doing that. So it probably didn't take much for her to come across as uppity. I mean, that's just supposition on my part. But I mean, it's interesting with Chen Minghua, who turns out to be a very important figure in her whole career. For years, like whenever I'd try and look up stuff about her on the internet, there were a couple things that would always come up, and neither of which were true as far as I can surmise. But one was, I think it was even just something that was passed around on discussion forums and stuff, where people would say, well, it's rumored that she was married to a producer, trying to explain this phenomenon that she actually was allowed to direct movies. There was sort of this line of argument that was, well, she was married to a very influential producer. So it basically, the idea being that he made these movies and she put her name on them, which is obviously not true. The other one was that Jackie Chan choreographed all of her films uncredited, which was, I think that was actually on allmovie.com or something like that.
Yeah, I've seen that on a couple of sites, and it's like, unless he was constantly flying over there, like, I don't see how that would happen. So
I mean, especially, during her auteur period in the early 80s. I mean, he was busy doing all his big hits like Project A and...
Right. And I think if he had choreographed those movies, I don't think they would look the way they look. I mean, the fighting is that in those movies is of a very different style than stuff. Yeah.
They worked together on Fantasy Mission Force, but that wasn't...
Right.
That was like near the end. And he was doing that as a favor...
Jimmy Wang Yu. So, but getting back to director Chen, there was rumors that they were involved in a relationship. And in fact, when they went to Singapore in summer of 1976 to promote China Armed Escort,
which is the sort of feature version of the TV series, but not quite.
Yeah, she's basically playing the same character, but under a different name, and the story is a little different, but the same basic story of this armed escort agency that's trying to escort someone, people who try to get in the way, and
they strip out some of the characters, because I think, as you described it to me on the series, she's one of three sisters.
Right,
and I think in the movie they got rid of the sisters. So focus on her as the star.
So anyway, when they were in Singapore, some magazines or newspapers there printed some of these rumors about her, and they actually filed an injunction in court in Singapore and had the papers removed from circulation for a couple months, and then it was, I think, in the end ruled groundless. But she's always replied that they're just friends, and he was kind of a mentor and the person responsible for her success, and that they had the same kind of vision of the kind of movies they wanted to create. And so they founded the film company together called Friends Film Company and made four films. And then he also directed two more films that were produced by another company, but she was also a part of that company. I mean, that's the thing, is even back then in the late 70s, she was already trying to take more control of her career by setting up distribution companies or investing in other production companies and lending her name as executive producer to other films that she wasn't starring in. The period I think that we're going to be talking tonight is her auteur period, which you can sort of see the slow development towards that in her early films, which are pretty much standard films. But when you get to a film like My Blade, My Life, which was, she served as the executive producer of the film. Chen Minghua was the director. And this film, you really get to see a glimpse of the pearl that we know from her, her 80s films. And that character,
I was calling it sort of the lone kung fu vagabond character, sort of this tramp character who wanders alone and in ragged clothing, and
appears in Miraculous Flower,
right? Then I think so, and so, but the genesis of that was in My Blade, My Life. Was that the first film? I mean, I think that's the earliest of her films I've seen where she does that character.
So let me just sort of run through the early films. So China Armed Escort was made sometime in 75 and released in 76. And it basically is a movie version of the Protectors TV show. One thing I suspect that it was probably more violent. And already in this film, you can sort of see the violent Pearl's violent style developing.
Yeah, it's a very violent film.
Then the film after that is kind of a sequel. It involves the same character, and that one's called Invincible Swordswoman, and that was came out in 1977. It was a pretty big hit in Taiwan, number 8 among the Chinese films in the box office that year. And that one becomes more of a showcase for Pearl. Sort of continues developing this sort of the character's a little odd, but not really eccentric, and very much kind of a mannish type of character. You see Pearl with the kind of headband and, definitely sort of more masculine than some of the other swordswomen of the time.
Now, I haven't seen Invincible Swordswoman, but I have seen China Armed Escort. And I mean, the thing that strikes, and I saw it after I'd seen films like Wolf Devil Woman and Matching Escort, and it did strike me that her character was more sort of severe and more serious, sort of this cold, steely-eyed assassin or bodyguard type character. There wasn't a lot of levity. There wasn't a lot of lightness or humor to the character that you'd see in her later films. Is that true generally of most of her earlier films? Or
the way I see it is, I think Pearl and her character, she's definitely kind of a loner character.
Right.
She's definitely a lone wolf, basically. And this is sort of reflected in her characters. And even in one of the articles I read, it talks about how, unlike other movie stars, she doesn't like to hang out or go partying or chat, likes to be alone. Sometimes people have a hard time.
There go my fantasies of partying with Pearl Changling. she plays that in the auteur films too. In Wolf Devil Woman, she is a loner too. But there's moments of goofiness. Like there's always sort of, she does some kind of clowning around. Like in Wolf Devil Woman, there's that scene in the tea house where she's eating, and like she always does these very exaggerated, almost sort of silent movie kind of shtick things where she's eating and she goes kind of cross-eyed while she's drinking, and it's just, there's just kind of a goofiness that she exhibits in those films that I didn't see in the earlier films.
Yeah, you don't really see that until in 1979 there's a film called Kings of Fists and Dollars, where she starred, actually David Jung, the Shaw star, it's kind of his film, and his character is the one who goes through the development through the course of the film. But she's got some sort of comedic moments in that, and I think that's where, and well, actually, what other, Witty Hand, Witty Sword, in the beginning, it's one of those transformations that you see so often in her films, where she plays this girl who likes to dress up as a boy, and her parents are killed, and she's on the run, and so she starts off from being this kind of happy-go-lucky person forced by her duty-bound to avenge her parents, to sort of grow up and take on that Avenger role, which,
right,
you know, you
right.
see yeah. that too in Miraculous Flower.
Right. And yeah, and also I think isn't it My Blade, My Life, where at first she's sort of this principled, you know, she's against the war and like the whole idea of conflict in the martial world, but then I think her father is killed and her father's retainer convinces her that she has to take up the sword and seek vengeance. So she's sort of this reluctant Avenger at the beginning of the movie. And then
yeah,
she
and
goes
that's General Invincible too.
And oh, that's maybe that's General.
That's Invincible. Yeah, it's General that's, Invincible. Yeah.
Okay, okay, sorry.
But when, in My Blade, My Life, it was, I think her parents were killed when she was a child, and
yeah.
I don't know who
oh, right.
got it or started training, well, but since childhood she was training herself to avenge
right.
her.
Basically, already, yeah, yeah, if you're her parents, you're dead. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, she's already well on the vengeance trail at the beginning of My Blade, My Life, and she's already... She's also... This is a similarity between... I tend to always think of her in the same Pearl in the same thought of Polly Shang Kwan, and there is that same thing between them. It's from movie to movie. It's like, okay, is she a girl masquerading as a boy? Is she playing a boy? There's always that sort of androgyny, and it's equally preposterous as it is in the Polly Shang Kwan movies, because there's no mistaking Pearl Chang Ling for a boy. But and I think in Dark Lady of Kung Fu, I by the end of the movie I was never really sure if she was just supposed to be playing a male character or not, because everybody just refers to as him through the whole movie, and there's no big reveal. I think in My Blade, My Life, there is a reveal where she says, you know, that she reveals towards the end of the movie that she's not, in fact, a boy. She's actually the daughter of such and such, and it's supposed to be this big, shocking, emotional moment.
That's sort of the experience of being a tomboy, which I think she definitely right. was. There's a funny picture I found, which is on my blog, of a ceremony for the top 10 stars in Taiwan of during 1977. And so Pearl's standing next to Bridget Lin, who was pretty much just making soapy romances at the time. Bridget Lin is gorgeous, high heels, this flowy white dress. And Pearl's dressed in this weird kind of like shimmery pantsuit with a jacket, and
uh-huh.
hair up in a ponytail, and looks like a total misfit. And I think uh-huh. she might even be the only lady, I don't know if she's wearing heels or not, but definitely tomboyish. And
mm-hmm.
and in this picture too, you really can sort of see her eccentricity as and,
yeah.
and her role as a kind of outcast, I think, in Taiwan film.
Yeah. Yeah, her outfits are pretty distinctive. I mean, her in the films as well. I think Tars, in his review of Dark Lady of Kung Fu, referred to one of her in her guise and as the masked heroine. She has this amazing winged costume with these super extended arms,
mm-hmm.
but in the other guise as this sort of Fagin character who leads this little gang of child bandits. Tars referred as to what she wears as looking kind of like strawberry shortcake gone
yes.
kung fu. It's really
yeah.
bizarre what
yeah.
she's wearing. Really yeah. bizarre.
I like that characterization, Taris. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that
yeah.
was good.
Yeah, she, I don't know if for sure, but I think she's definitely responsible for her costuming. And if you notice in all of her films, she's always got lots of kind of hair ornaments and
yes
yeah
and her costuming is always unique. Even Fantasy Mission Force, which is not her film, but you see her costume there, it's like total Pearl Chang. And
yeah
mm-hmm.
yeah and Wolf Devil Woman, during Wolf Devil Woman, I think she goes through the most transformations of any of her movies, because there's like these several distinct looks that she has throughout the film. I mean, most memorable is when she's the feral wolf girl, and she has like an entire stuffed dog
yeah.
on top of her head. But then
yeah.
there's the other scene where she's in her sort of waifish vagabond mode. And yeah, she has these ties in her hair that almost look like they're so big, they look like helicopter rotors. It looks
they're,
like
they're feathers. I think they're feathers.
I think you're right. They're
yeah.
feathers. She has big
yeah.
feathers in her hair. And then she has sort of this Bedouin costume
yeah.
she wears. And then, and then in the end, as in a few of her movies, she's like the avenging you know, sort of this sort of spirit of vengeance, and she's wearing these flowing white sort of robes.
Yeah.
It's very dramatic. And it's very effective because you've seen her go through all these weird transformations. So at the end, when she becomes this very sort of iconic archetypal figure, it makes it even more powerful because she's sort of been kind of goofy and weird up to that point. All right. So we were talking about My Blade, My Life.
And I mentioned that this is really the beginning of her sort of auteur period, where she's really comes up with this interesting, totally unique creation. And it has so many parallels with her later characters. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, maybe we just say a few words about the film and what we liked about it. One of the things I thought was really cool is just the way it opens is the story is Pearl's chasing down these handful of swordsmen who are responsible for the death of her father, I believe. And one of the first ones is played by Lole. He's like this lady man swordsman. Here it is, like one of the opening scenes is he is traveling through the desert with this entourage of ladies who are like carrying him on this big platform, you know, and there's all these like flowy curtains and, you know, then you see Pearl in her like, you know, sheepskin outfit with the limp. You know, very mysterious too, and that they shot it at towards sunset. It's got this really cool look, and so he comes out, and one of his ladies hands him this little glass of liquor, which he downs, and he washes his hands. And another lady, you know, brings him his sword, and then he pulls it out. And then in this film, Pearl's known for her like sort of one hit kills. They're like so fast, people don't even realize they've been hit. And she does that to him. And I thought it was so cool that it was almost, you could almost see Pearl like kind of proving herself as a swordswoman, as, you know, a player in the industry.
Right.
First target is the ladies' man, you know? And then so the rest of the film shows her on her journey to complete this sort of obsessive task of vengeance. And it's, What I really liked about it is you really see Pearl getting involved in this character, which is so unusual for a swordswoman character, because swordswoman characters are often kind of tomboys or maybe a little cold or...
Right.
But she takes it to a whole new level. Like
she does, yeah. I see a lot of influence in these movies, and I might be wrong, but I see a lot of influence of the spaghetti westerns in these movies. And in her character, she kind of reminds me of the man with no name from the Sergio Leone movies. And that's something that definitely Cho Yun used in Magic Blade. I mean, that's definitely a very conscious repurposing of the whole spaghetti western template to a Wuxia film, where you even had Ti Lung with sort of a modified version of the poncho that Clint Eastwood wears. And I see a little bit of that in Pearl's thing, except here she's wearing this rough cut like sheepskin and like burlap pants or something like that. But it's, and the whole idea of the entrance that she makes, you see her coming and it's facing the sun, and the whole sort of vibe of that character, my take on it.
No, well, it's interesting because I just came across a Chinese commentary about the film where they refer to her character as a female version of Di Long's character in The Magic Blade.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like her, this is sort of her take on it, because I mentioned before we started recording, you know, at the time, Cho Yun and all these films based on the Gulong novels were just like hugely popular, especially in Taiwan. And so that's sort of the backdrop of the setting for Pearl trying to carve out, you know, sort of niche or name for herself.
And this film actually, compared to some of her other films, it does, to me, it definitely had the look of a Shaw Brothers film. And there's some Shaw Brothers stars in it too, but it has sort of a slick... remind me of some of the Cho Yun movies, maybe not quite as ornate, but still had that kind of nice, slick, colorful look, and the fantasy elements. When there's some part where she's in the lair, there's like a gang called is this the movie where there's the Yin Yang gang or what? Yes, that whole sequence in the Yin Yang gang's lair with all the big different yin-yang motifs. That felt very much like something out of one of Choi Yun's movies to me, which obviously made me really like this movie because I like his movies so much. So.
Yeah, I think it indicates that Pearl and director Chen Ming-Hwa were definitely trying to go head-to-head with the big boys, Shaw Brothers, because they were total independents. And this film, which was produced by the company, the English name of the company is iFilm, which is Pearl was the vice chair of the company, and she founded it with Chen Wansen, who was the manager of a theater chain in Taiwan, the Today Theater chain. And so, obviously needed movies for his theaters and was sort of known for kind of well-respected in the industry and known for helping out independent production companies with to complete production by providing funding. And so with the Shaw Brothers, they were giants since long time. And, you could definitely see the industry people in Taiwan wanting to.
Right. They were the ones to beat.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's what's cool about her role of taking on all these other respected swordsmen. On a sort of meta level, it's almost like, okay, we're going to show you.
Right.
We're going to take you on. And yeah. It's still not at the level of the budgetary level of Shaw Brothers film, but what it lacks in sort of, budget, I think it more than makes up with her eccentric character and performance. Right.
And the violence in this movie is really intense, too.
Yeah.
As I recall, there's a part where she slices a guy's whole lower jaw off, and then she stabs a guy through the face with chopsticks. I mean, yes. There's some really... So I think they sort of tried to up the ante that way, too, of just really going for it, going there with the gore, too, which became definitely became a feature of her movies, too. Didn't
yeah.
Shy from the gore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one thing I read... On Chinese Gulong Forum, there was an article about her where the author said that some people referred to her as the female Zhang Che, Shaw Brothers director, who he was known as the violent director. And so she was sort of seen as sort of upping the ante, almost like for a woman in this industry, having to prove yourself, you almost have to be
tougher yeah.
and more violent. Mm-hmm. And,
right. Yeah, even in China Armed Escort, there were some really pretty shocking things. And it was the same sort of gimmick she had, too, where she was so fast that she could basically kill you before you even knew you were dead. Mm-hmm. Like, I think there was a scene in that where she basically decapitates a guy and he doesn't realize that he's been decapitated. Like, yeah. She just slices this guy and he's sort of feeling his neck going like something's not right here. And then another scene where she just drives her sword through the top of a guy's head. She flips overhead and just punctures this guy's head like a cocktail olive.
It's stunning. It's pretty
stunning. It was, yeah. I was like, whoa.
And what I kind of like is they, in that and also My Blade, My Life, they don't really linger over it.
No.
It's just like, you can almost miss it if you're not paying attention.
Absolutely.
It's so matter of fact.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes it that much. Yeah. It's very cold. It's very matter of fact. It's got just that's the way it's done.
Yeah. Know? But the other thing I really liked about the film is two things. One is it kind of almost has a sort of some kind of avant-garde tendencies or sort of art film tendencies and some parts. It even reminded me a little bit of Wong Kar-wai's Ashes of Time, where there's this definite moodiness. And I really like that sort of rapport between her character and Ling Yun's character, the Peerless Swallow, who that's her real target. And they end up becoming friends. And he is the one person that she starts to open up to.
Right.
And he knows that she's looking for him, but he's pretending he's not who he is. And they've got some wonderful moody scenes, the two of them getting to know each other. And I think it works really well, too, because Ling Yun, who was, I think he did a lot of the Choi Yun films, but he was also an actor in Taiwan back to maybe the late 50s, I'm not sure, but since the early 60s and then moved over to Shaw Brothers and really a great performer. And I think that's where you really see Pearl's, acting ability come out, because she's capable of going from like total slapstick to doing some really serious dramatic performances.
Absolutely. And, well, yeah, because there's definitely a tragic aspect to that tramp character that she plays too. I mean, there's the same thing in Miraculous Flower, and it even has her theme song where it's that she sings again, where she's talking about how, you know, what a lonely road it is for her, and she's always alone and has to fight alone. And it's the same thing. She's on this mission of vengeance, and she's honor bound to kill these people. But it turns out again that some of the people that she's honor bound to kill are people that she's bonded with in the course of her journey. And it's this hugely tragic thing. And there ends up being some very intense scenes where she confronts this guy who's become a father to her, and she has to kill him, and it's very intense. And there's been some very goofy stuff in the movie up to then, but it's still, all the goofy stuff sort of serves to make the tragic parts that much more kind of tragic, and it sort of underscores the heaviness of those scenes when they come up. And she does do really well in those.
Yeah.
In those contexts.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about her, is unlike some other swordswoman characters, even just regular martial arts characters who tend to be a little one-dimensional, she really portrays, you know, I'm not saying super realistically fleshed out characters, but because she shows so many facets, they really do, and, you know, maybe she's just playing herself, but they really do feel like real people who go through changes and go through a real journey from the beginning of the film to the end.
Definitely.
And just the little eccentric things, you know, like the limbs or the goofy little looks. And like you said, that really sort of completes the portrait. It gives there's a lot of depth and contrast rather than just a sort of the stone faced swordswoman.
Right. Right, exactly, the unflappable swordswoman. It's the opposite. And yeah, and a lot of them, I feel like the sort of goofiness gives her character sort of a childlike quality. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of the transformations you see her go through, she'll sort of start out as this sort of goofy, childish persona, and then sort of it's done in this very sort of broad stroke archetypal way, but there's this idea. You know, you definitely see the sort of drama of innocence lost as the movie goes on.
Yeah, when she switches to the solid color uniform, you know, it's
right.
Business time. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's it. I mean, one of my favorite scenes in any of her movies is that scene in Wolf Devil Woman where it's like this wire scene where she comes down, she floats down. I think it's the first time that you see her in her all white garb.
Yeah.
That's where she's finally evolved into the final form of this avenging female who's finally going to right the wrongs. And it's a nighttime scene where she glides down off the parapet of this fortress in these flowing white robes with her sword. And this is after we've seen her, you know, wearing the dog, stuffed dog on her head and all the different goofy costumes. But then seeing that transformation, it's like a real whoa moment. It's really powerful.
Yeah.
So join us next time as we discuss more of Pearl's films, including her big five auteur features. And before we leave you this episode, we have a sponsor this week, and it's the Monster Island Resort podcast from Miguel Rodriguez, who's a friend of a show and a friend of ours on Twitter, and also a fellow agent of the Mysterious Order of the Skeleton Suit. His podcast is pretty awesome, but he does a far better job of selling it than I ever could. So let's hear his promo now.
For lovers of horror to come together and celebrate the importance of fear in film, art, literature, comics, and history, Monster Island Resort is the perfect online audio vacation spot. And now, you too can do the Transylvania twist with a new segment of Monster Music, hosted by Strange Jason of the Great 6 Foot Plus and Gravediggers Local 16. If you love classic monsters, kaiju, science gone wrong, slashers, and more, then join your host, Miguel Rodriguez, on Monster Island Resort, the online radio show that goes bump in the night. Listen on monsterislandresort.org, iTunes, or Stitcher Radio.
The promo of Monster Island Resort was part of a trade in promos that we did with Miguel's podcast. If you want to hear, well, you should listen to Monster Island Resort anyway, but if you do, you'll hear our promo that we did, which features music, which was done by a friend of mine, Dan Wool. I just wanted to give him credit.
Yes. Thank you, Dan, for the use of your work. And if anyone out there wants to become a sponsor of our show and trade promos of us, feel free to contact Todd or I through our respective websites. Please keep your promo below 90 seconds just because for time purposes.
Also, if you have any comments on the podcast, too, feel free, negative or positive. But if they're negative, send them to Tars. And if they're positive, send them to me.
Yes. And also make sure they're in list format if they're negative.
Yeah. Bullet points, please, because, you know, block paragraphs full of cursing and you know, unsavory innuendo or
no caps. It hurts our feelings.
Right. Yeah. Lay off the caps key. Okay.
So until next time, it's to be continued.